The following podcast is part of a certified educational activity titled Finite Therapy, Infinite Possibilities in CLL, Exploring the Rapid Emergence of Newer Time-Limited BTKI Combinations. Access the entire activity and complete the post-test at peerview.com/BGH860. Downloadable slides and practice aids are also available.
Hello and welcome, everybody. Dear friends and dear colleagues, it is my great pleasure to welcome you to this satellite symposium at this wonderful ESH meeting. My name is Stefan Stiegenbauer from Ulm University in Germany, and it is my great pleasure to have my distinguished colleagues and good friends, Dr. Lidia Scarfo from the San Raffaele National Cancer Institute in Milan, Italy here, and Dr. Matt Davids from Harvard University and Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. Thanks to these internationally highly reputed experts, I think we will have an excellent symposium here. Now, brief word of introduction from my side. This symposium is about finite treatment durations with infinite opportunities that we can meet with these treatment options. Just a little bit of background, you're all aware of this. BTK inhibitors, in particular covalent BTK inhibitors such as ibrutinib, acalabrutinib, and zanubrutinib, are widely used in CLL frontline treatment as well as in relapse. And ibrutinib, at least in Europe, is licensed in combination with venetoclax for finite duration frontline treatment of CLL. Non-covalent inhibitors such as pirtobrutinib and nemtabrutinib are still more experimental, licensed for refractory cases in the United States and in further development. Of note, also the second generation covalent BTK inhibitors such as acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib are both in development in combination with venetoclax and other partners, clearly illustrating that these combo treatments are deemed a way forward in the further development and further improvement of our patient management. Now, this is also illustrated with within the German Oncopedia guidelines for frontline treatment of CLL. I don't want to go into all details here, but in yellow, you see the preferred treatment options. These are obinutuzumab venetoclax or continuous BTK inhibitor monotherapy, or already about 2 years ago when we drafted those outlined ibrutinib plus venetoclax, which at that point, because the data was a bit immature, not the top priority, but I think we have to revise these guidelines with the data from the GLOW trial, the CAPTIVATE trial, and more recently the FLARE trial that we will cover in this symposium, that clearly position ibrutinib plus venetoclax as a very valuable treatment option. Now, similarly, the NCCN guidelines, remarkably so, illustrate not only the continuous BTK inhibitors and the venetoclax obinutuzumab combo treatment, but also ibrutinib plus venetoclax as a recommended treatment option, although this regimen is actually not licensed by the FDA in the United States. Now, on the other hand, much work remains to be done because, as illustrated in this survey, which is actually very current from the last ASH meeting, we see in a survey of over 6,000 patients with CLL that although the majority of patients today is treated with targeted agents, the majority actually with continuous BTK inhibitor monotherapy, quite a proportion of patients, about 20%, are still receiving chemoimmunotherapy in their frontline management, which, based on the data that we will discuss with you in a minute, is not an adequate approach anymore. Now, therefore, the goals of this meeting and our session today is to augment the understanding of all of us for the evidence supporting different BTKI, BCL2I platforms in the treatment of CLL, to equip you with the skills you need to develop personalized treatment approaches for individual patients with fixed duration combination treatments, and to provide guidance how to address practical aspects of care in patients with CLL with finite therapy. And at this point, I'm very much looking forward to our distinguished faculty, and Dr. Lidia Scarfo from Milan will give the first presentation. Lidia.
Thank you, Stefan. Thank you for having me today. I have the chance to discuss with you the information currently available on time-limited therapy, including BTK inhibitors. But there are a lot of questions for the road ahead, and we will discuss this. So let's start by meeting our patient, Isabella, a 60-year-old patient who was diagnosed with CLL a few years ago, and now she's progressing and requiring treatment. She presents with B symptoms, splenomegaly, progressive lymphadenopathy that are now reaching 10 centimeters and even more. And if you check the lab test, you see that she has developed anemia and thrombocytopenia. She has no relevant comorbidities. According to the guidelines, we tested at this point the biomarker profile, and we found that she's carrying unmutated immunoglobulin gene in the absence of TP53 aberration. So, provided that she is experiencing a progressive CLL, what I want to discuss with my fellow panelists is what they think is the best therapy for this patient, fixed durations versus continuous treatment, and what are the goals of treatment in these young, fit patients? Don't know who want to start first, Matt?
Sure, I can start. So this is a relatively young and fit CLL patient who has a higher risk marker with unmutated IGHV, pretty bulky lymph node disease, and significant marrow involvement. So I think any of the options are reasonable to discuss with the patient. I tend to lean toward venetoclax plus obinutuzumab as a fixed duration therapy for most patients. I would say in this case, I'm a little concerned about the bulky lymphadenopathy. We have some hints that with such large lymph nodes, maybe a BTK inhibitor may result in longer PFS. So I think continuous BTKI is also a good option. And because the patient does not have a lot of comorbidities, I think ibrutinib plus venetoclax would be very reasonable as well.
So it's not available in US, right?
We would be able to use it probably off-label, although you're right, it's technically not approved.
Okay, Stefan, what's the European perspective?
Well, I think, this is a young patient, otherwise typical characteristics, clearly in need of treatment, unmutated IGHV, as we expect for the majority of patients who need treatment. Matt obviously proposed a very good choice. Continuous BTK inhibitor, on the other hand, monotherapy showed an overall survival benefit in this population as compared to chemoimmunotherapy, at least. To me, combining the best of two worlds, namely a BTK inhibitor and a BCL2 inhibitor, could be very valuable in this patient because there's no real relevant cardiac comorbidity and we have a fixed duration treatment. That, with specifically for the ibrutinib venetoclax regimen, with a ibrutinib lead-in, may be beneficial in such a patient with regard to debulking and tumor lysis syndrome management.
So thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. We can start by discussing the data about the fixed duration regimen based on the administration of venetoclax plus obinutuzumab. The longest follow-up we have is in CLL14. The six-year follow-up has been recently presented. And it comes to no surprise that venetoclax plus obinutuzumab is better than chlorambucil plus obinutuzumab in elderly unfit patients. And you see that at 6 years, the PFS rate was more than 50%, and over 60% of patients treated with VEN-G did not require any further line of treatment. The combination of venetoclax plus obinutuzumab is indeed able to achieve very deep responses, 76% undetectable MRD in peripheral blood, 57% in the bone marrow, and the achievement of undetectable MRD is actually related with long-term disease control. So it's a prognostic factor telling us that the patient will remain in remission for a longer time from treatment, time from treatment stop. With fixed duration regimen, the most relevant burden of toxicity, of course, occurs during treatment administration. We see that with venetoclax plus obinutuzumab, there is a relevant rate of neutropenia that is generally managed with the administration of G-CSF, less frequent thrombocytopenia, and also the occurrence of infection events is lower than with other regimens and with chemoimmunotherapy. And also the concern that was raised in the beginning on long-term risk of second primary malignancy was actually not confirmed with longer follow-up. On the other hand, as both Matt and Stefan already mentioned, there is another fixed duration regimen that has become recently available and should be considered in this patient. And I want to discuss with the panelists what are the logistical and the adverse events related consideration. Are there any toxicity mitigation plans you consider in your patients? And what are the goals of our treatment? Are we aiming at MRD undetectable? And are we considering the data available of on potential retreatment? So Stefan, you first this time.
This is obviously a relevant question. I think we also have from the audience some questions online submitted already going that direction. If we as a panel, and we may answer that, extend the BTK inhibitor lead-in sometimes in patients that have a very high tumor load to further enable venetoclax treatment start. To me, I think the regimen as devised with the three-month lead-in is very good, leading to no or negligible problems with tumor lysis syndrome management. Yes, further optimization, probably mostly of the BTK inhibitor component, appears desirable to me.
Yeah, I agree. To me, that's my major concern still with the ibrutinib venetoclax regimen is the cardiovascular toxicities with even in a younger fit patient can arise, and sometimes they can be serious. So still a lingering concern, and there's really no way to prepare for that other than very careful patient selection.
So in terms of treatment goals, because I see that there is also one question on these, are you extending the duration of treatment based on the MRD result?
Not outside of the context of a clinical trial right now. I'm using it as a way to sort of predict the duration of response likely, but I'm not necessarily extending the therapy.
Yes, I, similar to Matt, have a very strong opinion. I think we saw data earlier today that patients with mutated IGHV are less likely to achieve undetectable MRD and still have a better prognosis in the longer run. So to me, the whole question of solely MRD-guided treatment is challenged, in particular with this treatment combination.
I totally agree with this consideration. I'm sure you know that there is a strong preclinical rationale for combining BTK and BCL2 inhibitors because they are actually targeting two key mechanisms for survival and proliferation of CLL cells, and they have a preferential effect on different compartments, where ibrutinib is very effective in mobilizing CLL cells from lymph nodes, and venetoclax is targeting CLL cells in the peripheral blood and in the bone marrow. There are luckily enough clinical evidences that this preclinical rationale is actually translating into a benefit for our patients. And some studies were already presented and submitted for the regulatory approval of the combination. We will start with the GLOW study that was a phase 3 randomized trial where actually the eligible patients were elderly patients or patients carrying comorbidities. And they were randomized 1-to-1, hopefully for the last time, to ibrutinib plus venetoclax or the combination of chlorambucil plus obinutuzumab. Again, ibrutinib plus venetoclax was more effective in reducing the risk of progression compared to chlorambucil plus obinutuzumab. In this elderly patient population, as already mentioned by Matt and Stefan, actually we have to take care of the comorbidities and the potential toxicities associated with the administration of BTK inhibitors. As in the study, some events of sudden death and cardiovascular adverse events, grade 5, were actually reported, being mainly related with the heavy comorbidity burden in terms of cardiac comorbidities. More recently, the results of the CAPTIVATE study that was actually conducted in a young, fit patient population were updated. The study has a quite complex design, including one MRD-guided cohort, you see at the bottom, and a fixed-duration cohort where after 3 months of ibrutinib lead-in, venetoclax and ibrutinib were associated for up to 12 months. And then the treatment was stopped in every patient regardless of the achievement of the undetectable MRD status. The results, as mentioned, were recently updated at the last ASH meeting, and with a median follow-up of 56 months, the 54 months PFS remains very high at 70% for the whole cohort, with an overall survival of 97%. And the regimen was very promising, even in patients with high risk features, probably the only one who have a lower 54 months progression-free survival rate are again those carrying TP53 mutation or 17p deletion. In a younger fit patient population, the toxicity profile was less associated with cardiovascular adverse events. And as already mentioned by Stefan, the ibrutinib lead-in was actually able to reduce the tumor burden in the vast majority of patients from high risk for TLS to intermediate or low risk for TLS. And I think that the 3 months in our experience is a time span that is enough to reduce the lymphadenopathies in the vast majority of patients. What was also very promising is the summary of the results in patients who were retreated, most of them with ibrutinib single agent upon relapse after having received fixed duration of ibrutinib and venetoclax. And you see here the results presented around 30 patients, 22 were treated actually with ibrutinib alone and only 6 with ibrutinib plus venetoclax. The overall response rate was very high, so almost 90% of patients responded, the vast majority of them, of course, with a partial response, and the tolerability profile was very favorable. None of the patients discontinued treatment because of the adverse event. And what is also of great interest is that when they were tested for the presence of BTK or PCL2 gamma or PCL gamma 2 mutations associated with resistance on continuous treatment, none of the patients was carrying these mutations, and only one was carrying a BCL2 mutation of doubtful relevance, and in fact, he actually responded to retreatment with ibrutinib plus venetoclax. At the last ASH meeting, a very interesting approach, a quite complex one actually, was presented, where at variance with the studies I have already shown you, where the treatment is administered for a fixed duration of time, treatment duration was tailored according to the time required to achieve undetectable MRD. So patients who needed only 12 months to achieve undetectable MRD with the combination of ibrutinib plus venetoclax were treated in total for only 24 months. Patients who required 18 months were treated for 3 years, and so on. With the rationale that actually the diseases are very different, and some type of diseases may require longer time to achieve undetectable MRD, and so they deserve longer treatment duration. And here again, you see the results with a 3 and 4 year PFS that were very impressive in the ibrutinib plus venetoclax arm, with almost 97% patients being relapse-free, progression-free at 3 years, receiving ibrutinib plus venetoclax based on this MRD-guided approach. And this translates also in a benefit in terms of overall survival that you see is longer with the combination of ibrutinib plus venetoclax compared to FCR. The main benefit was seen in patients carrying unmutated immunoglobulin genes. The same combination was tested with a fixed duration approach in the Gaia trial. Here we have patients, young fit patient devoid of TP53 aberration, and you see on the right that the progression-free survival curves in patients receiving venetoclax plus obinutuzumab or venetoclax plus obinutuzumab plus ibrutinib, so with the addition of the anti-CD20 monoclonal antibody, were longer compared to the disease control achieved with chemoimmunotherapy. So here we are discussing about a potential role for triplets. So the addition of the anti-CD20 monoclonal antibodies to the combination of BTK and BCL2 inhibitors, that it's something that seems to improve the progression-free survival and the undetectable MRD rate, So it comes at a price. And you see on the left that the infection rate in black in patients receiving the triplet was more than 20% and was actually quite close to the infection rate in patients receiving chemoimmunotherapy, either SCR or BR. So I dare say that regarding the triplets in standard risk patient, the jury is still out, because on one side we have a benefit in terms of depth of response, but we are also exposing our patient to a higher risk of toxicities. Most of these studies were actually excluding patients carrying TP53 aberration, as I mentioned, because these are considered the high-risk patient, and because many of them had actually a randomization to chemoimmunotherapy arm, and it would be unethical to randomize patients with TP53 aberration to chemoimmunotherapy. So here the results of a study that Stefan's group conducted in Germany, where they were actually enrolling only previously treated patients with high-risk CLL defined by the presence of 17p deletion and or TP53 mutations, and they were treated. They were treating the patients with the combination of obinutuzumab, ibrutinib, and venetoclax. Treatment could be continued up to 36 months or based on investigator judgment, and could be stopped after 15 months of combined treatment if the patients achieve an undetectable complete response. So here you see the results that were recently updated and published with the 36-month PFS of almost 80%, so very impressive, and an overall survival of more than 90%. Again, with this combined treatment, the patients experience a higher rate of neutropenia and infectious event, especially, of course, where the three drugs were all combined together. So we have many questions at this point on what is the best treatment according to the biomarker profile, the comorbidity burden, the age of the patient, and we hope and we are looking forward to the results of the CLL17 trial, where we hope we can find some answers. At least the trial is enrolling untreated CLL patients, both fit and unfit, with or without TP53 aberration, and randomizing them 1:1:1 to ibrutinib continuous treatment, so until progression or an acceptable toxicity, the combination of venetoclax plus obinutuzumab for up to 12 months, and the combination of ibrutinib plus venetoclax for up to 15 months, with a primary endpoint of progression-free survival. So coming back to our patient, she is a 60-year-old lady, has no relevant comorbidity, and in particular no relevant cardiovascular comorbidities. She's basically experiencing all the criteria for progression: bulky lymph nodes, splenomegaly, anemia, and thrombocytopenia. From the biomarker profile, she is carrying unmutated immunoglobulin genes. So considering that the disease is causing very high tumor burden, I would consider a reasonable to administer to these patients a BTK inhibitor-based regimen. She's young. I would go actually for a fixed duration treatment. So based on the biomarker profile and the clinical manifestation of the disease, I would consider a treatment with ibrutinib plus venetoclax. In conclusion, I hope I convinced you that fixed duration regimens currently available have become practice-changing options in patients with treatment-naive chronic lymphocytic leukemia, that the combination of a BTK inhibitor and a BCL2 inhibitor is able to achieve very deep responses, and this translates in long-term disease control, also in patients with previously considered unfavorable disease feature, meaning mutated immunoglobulin gene mutation status. We have some very promising data with retreatment with ibrutinib in patients who relapse after fixed duration ibrutinib plus venetoclax. It still remains debated if the combination of ibrutinib plus venetoclax should be administered in a fixed duration way, or if it is better to adapt the treatment duration based on the MRD results. And I think this is worth designing ad hoc clinical trials. Thank you. I think we can now move to the future,
yes,
right?
Thank you very much, Lydia. Excellent. And with that, we move to Dr. Matt Davids from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and Harvard Medical School. Matt, please go ahead.
Thanks, Stefan. Thank you so much for the invitation to speak here. And now I get to talk about finite therapy with the newer BTK inhibitor platforms, which is what I'd really like to use for that patient. We'll talk about treatment planning, safety, and also implications for downstream care. So let's talk about an older patient now with need for CLL treatment. This is Michael. He's 74 years old. He has symptomatic CLL, originally diagnosed with asymptomatic CLL about 5 years earlier, but now over the last several months has developed B symptoms. He has some significant comorbidities, including hypertension and early stage COPD. His ECOG performance status is 2. You can see his blood counts there, clearly needs treatment based on the cytopenias. And the genetic markers again show unmutated IGHV and no TP53 aberration. So maybe Lydia can start with you on this one. Would this be a candidate for time-limited therapy?
I think we can consider time-limited therapy. I think we have data with the combination of venetoclax plus obinutuzumab in the elderly. The only thing is that with unmutated immunoglobulin gene system, that the progression-free survival group curve is dropping down earlier than in patients with mutated immunoglobulin genes. So this is probably the typical patient with whom I would discuss also logistics, meaning that choosing the administration of venetoclax plus obinutuzumab means that he has to come frequently to the hospital, especially in the first weeks. And while probably a continuous BTK inhibitor is, let's say, an easier choice from the logistic perspective, but I think both options are reasonable in this patient.
And Stefan, if you were going to choose a fixed duration venetoclax-based therapy, would you use obinutuzumab or ibrutinib here as your preferred partner?
Well, to me, as you said, it's both are valuable options. We have a little longer-term experience with obinutuzumab plus venetoclax, but as Lydia said, it's to me much a management issue regarding, you know, coming to hospital in the beginning, as we know, several times a week, then weekly, infusion-related reaction management with OB. So I'll discuss both options with the patient, and usually there's a preference.
Okay. So let's talk now about this last question. Is there a future role for second-generation BTK inhibitors with venetoclax in combination? So let's talk first about some of the foundational and head-to-head evidence with the newer covalent BTK inhibitors. So first, the longer-term follow-up with acalabrutinib was presented at the ASH meeting this past year. This is 6-year data from the ELEVATE-TN study, which randomized patients in a 1-to-1-to-1 fashion to acalabrutinib with or without an initial 6-month or so combination of obinutuzumab to the control arm of chlorambucil plus obinutuzumab. And you see with longer follow-up, both acalabrutinib arms, not surprisingly, are still superior to obinutuzumab chlorambucil. But I think somewhat surprisingly, we continue to see this significant improvement in PFS of the acala-obin versus acala monotherapy. It's about 16% absolute difference now at 6 years. This is a post-hoc analysis, and the study's not really powered to show a difference between these arms, but I think it is still provocative. And you know, I think it's certainly very different from what we saw with ibrutinib and rituximab, where we saw no difference there. We also now have longer-term follow-up from the Sequoia study that were presented last summer. This was zanubrutinib versus BR in frontline population without deletion 17P. Here you can see the median PFS has not yet been reached with zanubrutinib at a little over 3.5 years of follow-up, which was superior to BR. So clearly also zanubrutinib very effective in this context. So we've known about the kinome plots for these drugs for a while now. What are the implications for off-target effects and safety? Certainly with ibrutinib, we do worry about some of the specific off-target effects on kinases like the TEC family or EGFR, leading to various complications we know about. And we now have not just theoretical evidence, but we have head-to-head trials confirming this hypothesis that the more selective BTK inhibitors indeed do have fewer off-target effects compared to ibrutinib. So just briefly, one slide on each of these studies. We'll hear more about this, I'm sure, at the meeting, but Elevate RR read out first. This had a median follow-up of about 41 months in a relapsed refractory CLL population that was enriched for patients with higher risk markers, particularly deletion 17p and also some patients with 11q deletion. And you see here graphically significantly lower rates of AFib flutter, hypertension, and bleeding with acalabrutinib as compared to ibrutinib in this context. And I think a good overall measure of the tolerability of the drug is the treatment discontinuation rate because of AEs. And you can see also this favored acalabrutinib at around 14% compared to 21% with ibrutinib. And notably, this study showed that acalabrutinib was non-inferior to ibrutinib from an efficacy perspective, which was the primary endpoint of the study. We've also seen data with zanubrutinib head-to-head with ibrutinib from the Alpine study, also a relapsed refractory CLL population. This population was not enriched for high-risk patients, but did include a fair number of high-risk patients. And again, you see significantly lower rates of several different cardiovascular toxicities, particularly AFib flutter was lower with zanubrutinib compared to ibrutinib. You did see similar rates of hypertension between the two drugs in this study and a similar rate of overall bleeding. But again, the tolerability of zanubrutinib was far better than ibrutinib, as illustrated by the treatment discontinuation rate being just under 20% compared to 26% with ibrutinib. And although it wasn't the primary endpoint of the study, the progression-free survival favored zanubrutinib over ibrutinib in Alpine, which I think was quite remarkable as well. So very valuable data sets from the head-to-head studies. So now let's think about finite therapy with second-generation BTK inhibitors and venetoclax, and specifically for our patient Michael now. What's the evidence for finite therapy with the newer BTK plus Ven combinations? What's the potential impact of the high-risk features? We'll talk a little bit about resistance for subsequent treatment, and then whether continuous therapy might be preferred. So we've tweaked the case a little bit now, and we'll say that everything else is the same, except now Michael has high-risk disease, either TP53 mutation and or deletion 17P. So Stefan, maybe how does this change your calculus? Is this automatically continuous BTKI? Is this still a patient you could consider for fixed duration therapy?
Right. I mean, this is the population that is still challenging, even those days. I think we do not really have comparative data from a single trial testing different approaches in this population. This is why we have a limited body of evidence or strength of data, because we lay trials side by side. It looks like a continuous BTK inhibitor monotherapy in cross-trial comparisons performs better. However, we base this opinion mostly on progression-free survival to the first progression, while with fixed duration treatments, there's usually the option of retreatment. I think it also depends not only on that factor, but again, on patient characteristics. And I wouldn't exclude Ven-OB or ibrutinib venetoclax as a treatment option for a patient with a deletion 17P in particular, if there's comorbidity that makes you want to abstain from long-term BTK inhibitor treatment.
Lydia, anything to add to that?
No, I totally agree. Actually, this is the type of patients I'm generally considering for continuous BTK inhibitor treatment. We can discuss philosophically if the size of the clone matters, meaning that you did not specify how large the clone was. But I dare say that nowadays I feel more confident with continuous BTKI.
Okay. So let's talk about some of the newer BTK inhibitor combinations with venetoclax, starting with Sequoia Arm D. So in that same Sequoia frontline study with zanubrutinib, patients with deletion 17P were taken out and not randomized. They went into different cohorts. There was a zanubrutinib monotherapy cohort, and then what I'm showing you here is zanubrutinib plus venetoclax. You can see from the schema here, patients got a three-cycle lead-in of zanubrutinib and then the typical venetoclax ramp-up, and they got at least a year of combination therapy of zanu-venetoclax, and there were discontinuation rules based on when they achieved undetectable MRD. So these are older data now. This is from ASH 2021, but at that point, at least there was a very high overall response rate that you see in the top right. Some patients had already achieved CR, CRI, even with early follow-up. So clearly, this is a very active regimen. There was no reported clinical TLS with that reduction of disease burden with the zanubrutinib. There were no dose reductions needed for AEs and relatively low incidence of some of the typical toxicities like neutropenia, diarrhea, and nausea. So certainly looking forward to seeing updated data on this data set soon.
We have also triplet data now for zanubrutinib with venetoclax and obinutuzumab. This comes mostly from the Bovin study, which is an IST led by Jake Sumerai at MGH, also at a Memorial Sloan Kettering. So initially they presented and published data on 39 patients treated with this triplet regimen. Their study had about 13% of patients with TP53 aberration and 72% with unmutated IJHV. And from this initial publication, with a median follow-up of a little over 2 years, 89% of the patients had met the primary endpoint of undetectable MRD after 10 months. You can see from the swimmer plot on the right, with the darker blue color indicating on-treatment time and then the orangish-red color surveillance after treatment, that even at the time of this analysis, most of the patients had already been off therapy for longer than they were on therapy and remained in remission for the most part. And this was a relatively well-tolerated regimen as well. You can see some of the common AEs listed there. And in particular, grade 3 or higher neutropenia only occurred in about 18% of patients on that study. They did some more detailed analyses of MRD kinetics over time and certainly showed achievement of undetectable MRD. This is typically by flow at 10 to the minus 4. They showed that quite early. By 8 months, 81% of the patients had achieved this threshold. You can see that in the graph on the right. The best undetectable MRD rate was 95% in the blood and 89% in the marrow. And they used an MRD 400 change marker as a potential biomarker to identify patients who would achieve undetectable MRD early, which hopefully would predict for longer PFS. This is the safety summary, again, looking very nice from this initial 39 patients. Subsequent update of this study was presented last summer and looked quite similar. Again, grade 3 or higher neutropenia was one of the more common toxicities, but only 18% of patients. They did have one death that occurred due to a major bleeding event. So in parallel with that, we've been running our AVO triplet study, another investigator-initiated trial. When we last presented this, it was 68 patients enrolled. We've now completed accrual at 72 patients. And after the initial portion of the study, we amended the trial to restrict eligibility to those patients with TP53 aberrant disease to try to get more data, particularly on that high-risk population. So at the time of this presentation, about 60% of the population in this study had TP53 aberrancy, with about a quarter having complex karyotype defined as three or more abnormalities, and close to three quarters of patients with unmutated IJHV. So in our study, 86% of patients achieved bone marrow undetectable MRD after the initial 15-month triplet therapy. You can see that on the right in the orange bars. The rates of undetectable MRD were quite similar in patients with or without TP53 aberrancy, whether looking in the bone marrow or in the blood. And about in the blue bars, you can see about half of patients achieved CR at that cycle 16 reassessment. Responses have been quite durable so far. The PFS at a median follow-up of about 3 years is 93%. We also did a more detailed MRD analysis using the next generation sequencing platform ClonoSeq, where we looked down to the level of 10 to the minus fifth here. And you can see that about 60% of patients achieved undetectable MRD at that threshold after at cycle 16, and that this was preserved at cycle 25, still around 60%. And again, with no apparent differences in undetectable MRD rates based on TP53 status. This is the safety summary from our AVO trial. Also, this was well tolerated. Our rates of grade 3 or higher neutropenia were a bit higher at 37%, but we saw no episodes of febrile neutropenia. In general, infectious complications were similar to what we see with other regimens in CLL. We only saw atrial fibrillation in a couple of patients, so 3% rate, no other significant cardiovascular toxicities, no major bleeding events, and only about 20% of patients required dose reduction with either drug. So now there's a registrational trial that has fully accrued as of a few years ago called Amplify. So we hope to see results from this soon. This is a randomized study of previously untreated CLL patients without TP53 aberration to acalabrutinib venetoclax as a doublet, AVO as a triplet, or a control arm of FCR or BR. Both of the AV-based arms are fixed duration. They're not MRD-guided, so they're a one-year combination of the therapies. And the primary endpoint of this study is an IRC comparison of PFS between the AV doublet and the chemo immunotherapy arm, although key secondary endpoints will include the AVO triplet versus chemo immunotherapy, as well as investigator-assessed PFS. The study is also not powered to look at a difference between AVO and AV, although I'm sure we'll make that comparison once we have some data. The phase 3 CLL16 trial is ongoing now in Germany. This is looking at the efficacy of the AVO triplet versus Ven-Obin, specifically in the high-risk patients with TP53 aberration. 178 patients eventually will be randomized in a 2-to-1 fashion to AVO versus Ven-Obin. So this will be a very important data set for those high-risk patients to really understand the potential benefit of adding the BTK inhibitor to the venetoclax-obinutuzumab backbone. And then the MAGIC study is looking to test what's the optimal doublet combination of venetoclax. Is it acalabrutinib with venetoclax or obinutuzumab in venetoclax? This is hopefully going to accrue a total of 750 patients at 40 sites around the world. It's all comers when it comes to prognostic factors and age and so forth, and a one-to-one randomization. A couple of innovative aspects of the study. One is that we're using MRD guidance to determine length of therapy in both arms. I think that's particularly interesting for the ven-obin arm. Patients who still have detectable MRD at 10 to the minus fifth after the typical 12 months of ven-obin can go on to get a second year of venetoclax therapy in that arm. And then in the AV arm, patients can get a second year of AV therapy if they're still detectable after that first 12-month combination. The other innovative aspect is that we're using the clonoSEQ assay at 10 to the minus fifth as the decision-making tool for that. So hopefully that will pan out as a feasible way to assess MRD. And then eventually we'll look at a primary endpoint of progression-free survival in an event-driven analysis. So I wanted to touch on also, and Lydia brought this up in her talk briefly, but what have we learned about resistance mechanisms to finite therapy with targeted agents? And we're going to have a whole session on this at the meeting tomorrow. But just very briefly, I think we have started to learn more about resistance to monotherapy with targeted agents in CLL. Just a couple examples on the left with continuous BTK inhibitors, with covalent inhibitors from ELEVATE-RR, for example, and from Alpine. We see these typical BTK C481S mutations, also PLC gamma 2 mutations. And then on the right, with venetoclax as a monotherapy, we see a variety of different BCL2 mutations, such as the G101V mutation and others that can arise. Other groups, including our own, have described functional resistance mechanisms to venetoclax, such as hyperphosphorylation events. So it's becoming clear that when we leave CLL patients on one targeted therapy for a long period of time, eventually the CLL finds a way to outsmart the treatment. And so I think from a theoretical perspective, that's one of the things that's really appealing about the combination time-limited therapies, to try to take that selective pressure off the CLL cells. And we have some early clues that that may be the case. So from the CLL14 study, there have been very few progression events so far. About 25 patients on ven-obin have progressed. But as you see, there's been no acquired mutations in BCL2 or other apoptotic family member genes like BIM or BAX, BCLXL, or MCL1. You can see in general, it's a pretty quiet profile of genomic aberrations after ven-obin, especially as compared to obin-chlorambucil, where you see a number of other mutations, notably TP53 mutations. So I think this is promising in terms of the future potential for retreatment strategies with ven-obin. Similarly, we saw data recently published from the CAPTIVATE study. Lydia mentioned this before. This is, again, ibrutinib plus venetoclax, where patients had a time-limited therapy, and then later when they relapsed, they were then sequenced for mutations in BTK or PLC gamma 2. And 25 of the 29 patients on this study have been sequenced, and no mutations have been identified in either of those genes. So again, very promising that we'd be able to reuse BTK plus BCL2 strategies down the road. So let's go back to Michael's case. So let's start with the variation of unmutated IGHV, but no TP53 aberration. So certainly continuous BTK inhibitor would be a reasonable strategy here, but finite therapy should also be considered. I think that given the approved options right now, personally, I would feel more comfortable with ven-obin in this patient versus ven-ibrutinib. And I say that because this is a patient who has hypertension already, COPD, performance status of 2, already in the mid-70s. So I'm worried about cardiovascular risks with ibrutinib. But on the other hand, as we've seen now from some of the data that I showed you, the time-limited platform with more selective BTK inhibitors plus venetoclax may be a good option for a patient like this. May really be helpful to be able to deliver that therapy more safely with a more selective BTK inhibitor. So concluding thoughts on this section, acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib are clearly more selective BTK inhibitors than ibrutinib and have been proven to be safer than ibrutinib in the head-to-head studies. Acalaven and zanuven, whether given with or without CD20 antibodies, are now in development and do look promising, although neither is approved yet as a regimen. Once they are approved, I think that the more selective BTK inhibitor ven-based regimens may allow us to extend the benefits of these oral finite therapies to a broader range of CLL patients, particularly those older patients who have significant comorbidities. And there may be some real advantages to all oral therapy, I think, for patients in terms of some of the logistical issues we discussed around infusions with obinutuzumab. And then we touched on the resistance mechanisms. We certainly have a better sense now for the resistance mechanisms to targeted agent monotherapy. I'd say so far it's a little more mysterious as to why patients are relapsing after the combination approaches. I think we need more data there to understand resistance mechanisms, but at least so far it looks promising that we'll be able to retreat these patients at time of future progression.
So thank you very much, Matt.
So we do have time for discussion and for questions, and please come up to the microphones and ask your questions. This is the opportunity to challenge Lydia and Matt with your views or ask your questions. So please go ahead, come up to the microphone and ask what you ever dare to ask both of them. While people are coming up, maybe I pick some of the questions that we get submitted here. Matt, you also showed the intriguing data of obinutuzumab added to acalabrutinib in the ELEVATE-TN trial. When is that your choice with regard to a not finite duration, but also a good combination treatment, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an excellent combination treatment, and I have had patients where they really want to maximize their PFS and they don't mind being on a continuous therapy. And so that is a scenario where I might consider that combination. I would say in practice, as I start to describe the obinutuzumab infusions to patients, it is pretty involved and there's no overall survival benefit. And often the patients who are willing to go through the obinutuzumab infusions are also willing to do the venetoclax ramp up. So then the conversation often veers back to time-limited ven-obin. So I don't tend to use it too much, but again, if the patient's okay with continuous treatment and doesn't mind the infusions, it's really a good way to have a very long PFS.
Right. Unless there are other questions from the floor, I pick another one from the online submitted ones. Again, coming back actually a number of times here to the chemoimmunotherapy question. I mean, I was hesitant because I thought you show the data Lydia, I mean, with Flair showing this early and impressive separation of the overall survival curves of ibrutinib plus venetoclax as compared to FCR, at least for me, I didn't want to say it to be kind of influential before, but to me, this is actually the last nail in the coffin that we needed of chemoimmunotherapy and CLL, or am I wrong here?
I totally agree with you. Actually, it's true that the main benefit was driven by the unmutated immunoglobulin gene patients. And of course, this category of patients is the one who was less benefiting from FCR. But I always feel that patients with mutated immunoglobulin gene are somehow discriminated because they have a good disease and they do not receive the best treatment we have available, basically because they respond to everything. I understand that FCR, and I'm looking at Bill Birda sitting in the front row, can achieve long-term, let's say, functional cure, but this comes at potentially the price of MDS, AML, other malignancies, so I'm not entirely convinced that this is the best way to go nowadays, even for patients with mutated immunoglobulin genes.
Yeah, and one may add that at least given, I mean, the follow-up with venetoclax-based chemo-free regimens is shorter. We cannot claim that long-term outcome, but at least from MRD evidence level, let's say we achieve deeper MRD responses with venetoclax-based chemo-free treatments than we do with FCR, which should enhance our confidence. Matt, maybe to you, I'm also coming back to the chemo question. Sorry to be old-fashioned here. Do you ever consider debulking with bendamustine in a high-risk, high tumor burden patient?
I do not, personally. I find that if patients have significant circulating disease, debulking with obinutuzumab as part of the ven-obin regimen makes sense. If it's more bulky lymph node disease, usually the BTK inhibitor is very effective at doing that. So even a short course of chemotherapy may introduce some risk of clonal evolution, infectious complications, etc. So I typically do not do that.
I totally agree with Matt. Actually, sometimes what we can do as, let's say, off-label schedule is to start with venetoclax because you designed the regimen as representative of the German CLL study group in order to reduce the risk of TLS that was, let's say, the main potential toxicity initially associated with venetoclax. But I'd say that infusion-related reaction associated with obinutuzumab are frequently more difficult to manage, and we didn't experience any clinical TLS in our patient population. So I find safer sometimes to consider starting with venetoclax than with obinutuzumab.
Mm. Sure. Sorry, it's a bit difficult to see. I think there's a question over at the microphone.
Hi, Stefan. It's Toby here. A question about sort of how we use our MRD sort of results that we have now to sort of move forward strategically. We've clearly got a number of really interesting data sets demonstrating sort of the biological rationale and the reasoning for it and randomized trials now. How do we encourage sort of industry to move forward with MRD testing in pivotal studies? Are we going to reach an era where we have therapies that are sort of licensed and approved with MRD strategies associated with it? Where do you see the sort of field broadly heading here? Or will fixed duration therapies sort of dominate for the foreseeable future? So I guess there's a bit of sort of blue sky thinking about what's to come with MRD.
Sure, I can start with that. I mean, I felt like we were on a good track with chemoimmunotherapy and Ven CD20. MRD was very predictive of PFS and OS. And now we see these data sets emerging with Ven BTK, where MRD is not predictive of PFS. It's actually IGHV status that's more predictive. So I don't know what to make of that yet. I think obviously we need to have more data, longer follow-up. But if that really proves to be the case, then maybe MRD-guided therapy is not the best approach. Maybe we should be guiding therapy duration based on IGHV mutational status. Maybe, as Paulo was saying earlier, some kind of kinetics of MRD may influence that decision. But I feel like from a regulatory perspective, it's challenging now because, again, we're in a situation where MRD may not be strictly predictive.
Totally agree. I think that the design of the FLAIR study was brilliant, but it's very difficult to translate it in the clinical practice. But I think that MRD has the potential to be a very powerful tool. We should find a way to use it even in routine care. And probably the best way is to design clinical trial comparing fixed duration with MRD-driven approach as the CLL18, where we are comparing different treatment arms using the same drugs, but with different approaches. And I slightly disagree that MRD is not relevant with BTKI and BCL2I-based regimen. It's not the only factor, meaning that probably we should take into account also other biomarkers, including immunoglobulin gene mutation status, as you correctly mentioned. But once the patient reach undetectable in MRD, I think this means some things in terms of disease responsiveness.
Right. So, I mean, maybe we're close to the end of the session, but maybe while I move over for the brief words of extra here, we alluded to that a little bit, but your views, is unmutated IGHV, because it was also one of the questions submitted here, still a risk factor, even in the era of these novel treatments? Maybe both of you, brief statement.
I think this is the factor we should assess in order to define the best treatment option for the patients. At variance with what was in the past, where we had only one treatment option and we could use it, and so it has only a prognostic value. Let's say we know that the patients will do worse. I think this is a relevant factor in order to decide the best strategy for the patient.
Yeah, I agree. I think if anything, it's become even more relevant again, given this discussion that we're having, in addition to studies that look at MRD-guided versus fixed-duration therapy. I wonder if we should be designing studies that look at MRD-guided versus IGHV-guided therapy duration. That could also be very interesting.
Well, great. Thank you. Thank you very much, Matt. Thank you, Lydia, for this excellent session. I think we could go on for quite a while. Thank you very much.
This activity is certified by PVI, Peerview Institute for Medical Education, the European Board for Accreditation in Hematology, and Faculty of Pharmaceutical Medicine. Remember to download the slides and practice aids. Thank you for listening. Download materials and complete the post-test for instant credit at peerview.com/BGH860. This activity is supported by an independent educational grant from AstraZeneca.